It's Saturday, October 18th, 2014. We're broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KUSP Public Radio 88.9 and KUSP.org. It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP or any of the geeks' affiliated organizations. I'm Lyle Troxell, and with me in the studio is Mr. Ben Jaffe, a teacher, traveler, and total space nerd.
What's up?
Hey, Ben. How you doing?
Pretty good. How you doing?
And Ben, you've brought a guest today with you, Mr. Roger Jaffe, a high school engineering and math teacher and visitor from Southern California. Hi, Roger.
Good morning.
Now, you guys related?
Brothers.
You look exactly alike, so that is but maybe a few years difference.
Just a few.
All right. So let's talk about battery power, buddy.
Go for it, Ben. I love the headline. Smart battery tells you when it's about to explode.
Is it suicidal? Let's hope not.
I don't know. But no, actually, so basically, here's the deal. You've got these lithium ion batteries, and you've got your anode and your cathode, and you've got a polymer separator in between. And it turns out that when you overcharge the battery cell, a lot of times microscopic chains of lithium, we call them dendrites, they pierce through the polymer separator, they touch the cathode to the anode, and a current goes through, makes it warmer and warmer and warmer. Sometimes they explode. It's bad news. So basically what they're talking about, these researchers, they built a smarter separator, a separator that has basically a way of changing the voltage to a sensor when dendrites pierce it. So basically it can't stop the formation of the dendrites. That's what we've been working on all this time. Instead of trying to stop the problem, it's just saying, hey, there's a problem. You need to replace this battery. And so it's a good stopgap measure until we figure out how to get that issue under control.
Okay. So good. I mean, I'm glad that that's being worked on to warn. I'm assuming the warning would be like a high-pitched whine or something that would be useful.
Please replace me
instead
now.
I think I've got a problem.
Like a smoke alarm.
This reminds me of XKCD number 651.
Do you have that memorized?
Bag check. No, I had to check it out.
Okay.
And all this, XKCD is a comic that Ben and I both read. It's wonderful. It's XKCD.com. Of course, we'll link to it. Put up this image of this comic in the GeekSpeak website.
The only one that I read.
It's the only webcomic you read?
I don't read any other webcomics.
Wow.
I'm just not very compelled by webcomics. But this one is fantastic, especially if
you're all right, hear that, everybody? Send us good web comics, and Ben and I will start reading them and recommending others.
I'm having an experience of deja vu. I think we did this 9 months ago.
Possibly.
And I didn't get
any web comics?
No, none that I stuck with.
So this one's called Bag Check, and it's basically about going through a security checkpoint.
Uh-huh.
And he's got a battery, and they're talking about a bomb. They want to take his water away. And, of course, he's saying, I can just overvoltage the lithium ion battery, and it would explode. Not a good thing to do when you're going through security. In any case, check that out up at geekspeak.org at the end of the show. But let's move on, shall we? I thought I'd kind of merge two stories at once because it's been kind of fun. I was doing some work and driving a lot but needing to read some documents, and so I was having my phone read to me. Have you done that, Ben?
No, I've never done that.
Why haven't you done that?
I don't know how.
Seriously?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'm sure the feature exists somewhere or some app or something like that, but I have an Android device and The feature has never popped out at me and said, like, hey, make me say this. So OS X, though, on the other hand, my computer, I make my computer say all kinds of things.
All right. Well, let's go ahead and have my phone.
Oh, your iPhone.
Yeah, we'll do it with my iPhone. And we'll have my iPhone go ahead and read an introduction to, well, the phrasing story. I'll give you the introduction to the story. Snowden's CIA career taught him that he couldn't actually bring up issues. And this is kind of
Edward Snowden.
Edward Snowden. So Edward Snowden, of course, is on the run. He's gone away. He's changed fundamentally how we think about privacy and security in the United States. His revelations have been very informative and changed political politics. He's very impressive what he's done to society in a lot of ways. But one of the things that's been kind of a counter against him is, well, why didn't he just report this stuff directly? Why didn't he just use the whistleblower policies that exist in the NSA and the government in general to do this? And there's been a back and forth debate. And so this is a little bit of his. He did an interview recently where he talked about it. And so this is some quote of the interview read by my phone. I hope it sounds okay.
Mr. Snowden said that in 2008 and 2009, he was working in Geneva as a telecommunications information systems officer, handling everything from information technology and computer networks to maintenance of the heating and air conditioning systems. He began pushing for a promotion, but got into what he termed a petty email spat in which he questioned a senior manager's judgment.
Okay, so I'm not going to keep going because it's not fantastic as a read, but it definitely is fully functional.
She was reading really fast.
It was really fast.
Sorry, yes. I realized that I actually...
Can you control the speed?
You can. You can slow it down.
That's surely however, not the default.
So you were on light speed, were you?
I read everything, listen to everything very fast. I love that every time I ever play audio, it's like sped up.
Does that make you drive faster in the car?
No, it doesn't. No. It slows me
if
down.
If anything, it slows you down because yeah. You don't have as much brain throughput.
In any case, several months later, after he found this flaw, he wanted to report it. He was doing a self-evaluation, Snowden was, and which means, you know, he writes up some stuff about what he's been doing and some documentation, and he found there was a flaw in the system and tried to report it. His direct manager kind of said no. Then he tried to report it to another group, and finally he asked to prove that it was a problem, a flaw, by taking advantage of the flaw, hacking the system, and actually inserting an extra bit of knowledge, an extra bit of data into a document he'd already submitted of his self-evaluation. So he got approval and sign-off from his boss, but then later an upper-up person really targeted him and put it on his record that he'd been doing wrong. So he'd had some flaws with his experience of trying to report a problem and getting shushed before. So it's kind of interesting. And that story, of course, will be up at geekspeak.org.
Cool phone.
So, so what do you think of that audio? Maybe it's too fast. You're right, Roger. It's too fast.
But it was very understandable.
Yeah, it was clear, right?
You know,
maybe I'll do it again. I'll slow
it
down.
Wasn't your typical computer voice.
Right. Well, it's a little bit more enhanced than that, if you will. It gets better every
year. In the past, I've heard computer voices kind of talk at a monotone voice because they don't understand the ups and downs of a sentence. But, you know, your phone kind of da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Like that kind of a thing.
And you can get to this by settings and general and then accessibility. And then when I did the voice choices, the speech choices, I actually chose the voice that I'm using. Gosh, what is it? It's called Alex, and it's an enhanced one. It's 900. It takes a whole, almost a gig.
900
storage.
Megabytes.
969 megabytes.
Can you do other languages?
You can. You can do different languages, Dutch, and there's a whole bunch of them. You've got to download them as you want to use them. And then speaking rate, it looks like I was... Yeah, I can't set it to the normal rate, but I can turn it slower a little bit. So maybe I'll do that a little bit later in the show. Let's talk about Facebook.
Facebook, yeah. So So sometimes if there's a natural disaster or an earthquake or, you know, something like that, or September 11th events, those kinds of things, a lot of times you wonder whether your loved ones are okay. And Facebook just released a feature called Safety Check. So basically, let's say there's an earthquake in our area. Then Facebook will know about that. It'll be reported to Facebook, and then Facebook will activate this feature. And this feature will message anyone with Facebook on their phones or their devices and say, like, hey, are you okay? You were in an affected region by this earthquake or whatever it was. And then you can check, yes, I am okay, or you can, you know, ignore it or whatever. But the idea being that if you check, yes, I am okay, then all of the people who are your friends on Facebook can know that you're actually safe, so they don't worry about you.
So now,
at the beginning, like when I first read about that, I'm like, yes, that's an awesome feature. That's wonderful because people worry about other people, you know, when there's a shooting or an earthquake or something.
And if you know a lot of people and you've queued yourself to say, I'm okay, then anybody that wants to check on you already gets notified that you've queued it, right? It's not like if I texted everybody I know, that would take a long time. So there's a broadcasting quality about it that I do like.
Yeah, there's definitely good parts of it, but
the part that I don't like, and maybe it's the same as you, Ben, is if you're in an affected area, all of a sudden everybody starts using data automatically to get sent, you know, notifications to say, hey, Facebook, okay, and then everybody loads Facebook up, and of course when you load Facebook up, you download a whole bunch of data. So on an already congested security emergency environment, you're using a whole bunch of data for this.
Mm-hmm. Although I imagine that's already a problem enough that nobody can get data anyway.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's definitely limited utility for this if there's a widespread emergency. Then again, if you're on your home Wi-Fi or something like that, then, you know, it's wonderful. You're not congesting the cellular networks, which are used for emergency services, you know, and everything.
And I remember, was it the 1989 earthquake in the Bay Area?
Sure.
We have a lot of friends up here because we used to live here, and they couldn't communicate with each other because of all the communication problems, but they could call outside the area. So we received a lot of phone calls from our friends up here to just let everybody, and we were kind of the central contact point.
Down in Southern California.
Down in San Diego.
Right, right. Because if one person
they could call us, but they just couldn't call each other up here.
Right. And of course, that happened 25 years ago yesterday, I believe.
Wow.
Right.
Well.
All right. Well, shall we move on to growing things in your cereal? Because why not?
Oh, boy. Okay,
Wait. First off, let's try the slower voice. Let's see how that sounds.
In times of disaster or crisis, people turn to Facebook to check on loved ones and get updates.
I don't know if I really believe that, but I guess maybe that's true. I mean, in crisis, I don't go Facebook, but then again.
You know, a lot of people do.
Anyway, that's the slower voice. It sounded pretty, sounded like a good pace.
Sounded pretty good. It felt like it didn't know that Facebook is a single word.
Better right. pace, but more unnatural voice. It sounded more natural to me when it was faster.
Well, probably because when you're faster.
Facebook.
Yeah, probably because when you're faster, you drop some of the pauses and some of the natural speak patterns and sound more robotic when you go fast. Mm-hmm. That's why I sound like an Android, because I'm always speaking too fast.
I have immense respect for the people who write that software.
Yeah, it's hard stuff.
That requires a lot more knowledge than just computer science, you know, knowledge or software development. This is like, you're dealing with audio, you're dealing with speech, you're dealing with linguistics. It's such a huge, wide array of things you need to know about.
Absolutely. All right, Cheerios?
Cheerios now?
Yeah.
All right.
Cheerios now, man. We get some time.
All right. So some researchers were looking for these particular compounds. Actually, they didn't really know exactly what they were looking for, but they were
What kind of researchers?
These are researchers looking for compounds with potential medical or therapeutic value, right? So basically just new things that they could kind of play with or experiment with. And by trying to get this fungi to grow. And it turns out that they wanted a medium for the fungus to grow on that was consistent over time. And that's kind of difficult to
do. Right, because if you change the substrate, then of course the fungus is going to grow differently, not because of the organism, but because of the environment it's in. Sure.
Mm-hmm. And they found that cereal is a really good way to do this, because cereal is manufactured exactly the same way year after year after year. And they also found that of all of the cereals in the cereal aisle, the best cereal for growing fungus was Cheerios.
Do they have it? Why? Why is that? I mean, first off, they want the major brands so they have consistency.
Yes.
Cheerios definitely has a consistency to it, I would say.
They've been around since I don't know what decade. I'm going to show you a picture of this.
Oh, fungus growing on Cheerios.
It looks like a fuzzy donut.
Yeah.
A bunch of fuzzy donuts.
Delicious.
Yeah, I don't know. Anyway, I mean, I like Cheerios a lot.
So those scientists that need to do this... Here you go. Oh, wait. Is this a good thing for your classrooms? I guess you're not doing biology.
I teach engineering, not biology. Right. I just wonder how long do you have to keep the Cheerios in your pantry for that to get fuzzy?
Right. Well, I'm wondering.
Yeah, you have to seed it with something.
Oh, okay. So yeah, it doesn't just happen.
You don't just like leave some Cheerios.
I'm assuming a sealed box of Cheerios just won't grow anything. There's probably never going to rot, right? No moisture in there.
But if you seed it and reseal it.
And
it
add
turns
some water.
That, yeah, cereal, the Cheerios in a bag, in a closed bag. It's a really good way to grow fungus, and especially novel fungus for further study.
I like it, novel fungi, actually. I think that's
great. I get it all confused. Well, I don't know. I'm kind of riffing off of cactus and cacti. I know that both are actually correct. So
really?
So I don't actually know if fungus or fungi or funguses or what it is.
In a little bit, we're going to talk about USB slippers. We're going to talk about Comcast town voting, which is awesome. And Roger, we're going to talk a lot about your career as a teacher in high school and the technology you use. But first, Jonathan Keats has copyrighted his mind, attempted to genetically engineer God, made porno videos for plants, all in a day's work for the self-described experimental philosopher and conceptual artist. Keats says there's a method to his madness, and it's not all a big joke. He talks with KSP's Robert Pauly about his unusual career and describes his newest project, training bacteria for executive jobs. I wonder if he's going to do that on Cheerios. That's the 7th Avenue Project, Thinking Persons Radio with Robert Pauler, tomorrow here noon on KUSP. Check out his website at 7thAvenueProject.com. You're listening to Geek Speak. I'm Lyle Troxell, and with me in the room is Mr. Ben Jaffe and Mr. Roger Jaffe. Yes, there is a relation, but we won't get into that. Hey, I want to mention a past show of ours. In fact, I got cued by one of our listeners in the news. We talked a couple weeks ago about, I'll just read what Jim from Central Jersey says. While talking about something else, one of the geeks, Miles maybe, made reference to Adblock, which some people love, but which interferes with the ad-supported model of the free, as in free beer, internet. Do you guys have thoughts about Privacy Badger? And then he links to Privacy Badger. And that's Jim in Central Valley. And yes, Jim, we did mention Privacy Badger. By the Electronic Frontier Foundation on the episode of Geek Speak entitled Badger Corrects OpenSSL Spin with Pyramid Power.
That was a couple months ago, right?
Yeah, that was May, May 3rd of this year. So please feel free to check out that show along with hundreds and hundreds of other episodes of GeekSpeak up at geekspeak.org. And of course, everything we talk about on the show, we surmise and add links to and stuff at geekspeak.org. All right. So let's do some flight attendant news, shall we?
Yeah. When you fly, do you like having to put away everything, like put away your phone, turn off?
So I just recently flew from Oakland to Los Angeles for a little thing. And during that flight, I had an iPad out, which I had some movies I downloaded already. And we watched them from sitting down and buckling to landing. I never put it away. And the flight attendant saw me the entire time. I was flying Southwest. Awesome. So is that what you're talking about?
That's what I'm talking about, yeah. So last October, the FAA said personal electronic devices, your smartphone, your tablet, they won't interfere with a plane's functionality, surprise, surprise, and can be used during all phases of flight. So that, and you just flew.
I was on a plane 3 hours ago.
And
we had to put our stuff away.
What airline?
Southwest.
Really?
Really.
Maybe
this
is
why this surprises me.
Well, so did you have to put your phone in the airline?
Different rules. I did have Google Glass on and sideburns, so there is that. maybe Southwest. I'd assume that. Now, normally, if you're holding something heavy, you have to put that away during takeoff. And mm-hmm. when they're doing the lecture about safety and all that, everyone's actually supposed to watch. Like, that's part of the rules. So maybe
now,
they did the
flippers. To be fair,
yeah.
I had my Chromebook, which does have to
keyboard.
Go. And it has a keyboard and all that. But maybe if I had an iPad or my Kindle or my cell phone, they wouldn't have done that.
It might be about the size of the thing.
Maybe it's the size of the device.
It's true that a laptop, even a Chromebook that's relatively small like that, if you were in a situation where you wanted to evacuate and that landed on the ground and it stood up, you could trip over it.
Right.
An
mm-hmm.
iPad, a tablet, that kind of stuff is pretty mm-hmm. flat.
And, or a phone.
Yeah, so maybe okay. it's about the size
well,
of the
now I'm going to pay attention when I fly home.
Well, you use your wife's tablet, right? Doesn't she?
Yeah, she has a tablet. I have a Kindle with me.
Okay, you should both do this. Just test a few things. Excellent. Absolutely.
I'll try that.
So, anyway, the Association of Flight Attendants is suing the FAA, arguing that that change is no good, that it's causing passengers to ignore the emergency announcements and that these new
rules...
Like
I did.
Right. And then also that this is an interesting one. They're arguing that the new rules violate federal regulations requiring passengers to stow all items during takeoff and landing, which seems a little confusing to me because I've never ever heard of a flight attendant having a problem with someone reading a magazine or a book.
Yeah.
Or, you know, like what does stowing all items mean?
In the description, you're supposed to do that. I mean, if you read through the manuals and all that stuff, you are supposed to stow everything. But, you know, when it comes down
like
to your sharing
watch
a sandwich,
like
well, anything you're holding, you're supposed to have the idea. Even your jacket shouldn't be on your lap, right? Your jacket should be folded away. Because the idea is that mm-hmm. in an emergency, you want to get people out. And the takeoff and landing are the cycles when it's most likely to happen. And having stuff in the way is problematic. That's why you're supposed to stow it on the chair in front of you.
So I get that. I don't like the lack of consistency.
Yes.
Like over all of these years.
Right.
So,
that's one of those things where the policy's in place and when they feel like they can enforce it, there's power there and they can enforce it. So it's a power dynamic more than...
There's part of that, yeah. And just to be fair, this is not all flight attendants necessarily. You know,
sure.
You can't just paint such wide grand strokes. But this is the largest association of flight attendants, the union for flight attendants, the largest of them, saying this. So basically they're saying, you know what, no, we really should ban this stuff again. Like we should undo
well, it's interesting
because
I do think if you haven't flown before, if you've only flown every once in a while, you should probably hear the entire safety message, right? Like, that's an important thing. If you've flown, I don't know, 10 times in the last year, hearing it again is kind of ridiculous, right?
You're not going to get much with it.
And again, and again.
And again. And it's the same thing. It's almost comical. And I mean, sometimes people are really good at it. I mean, there's definitely different qualities about it.
Yeah. Well, it feels like there are two ways of going about this. There's the banning new technology or banning technology and people using it or working with it somehow.
Well, so speaking about banning technology in different environments, in the teaching profession, it's back and forth on what the right thing to do. And Roger is a high school teacher of physics and mathematics, been doing so for years. You've seen a classroom with no handheld tech to almost everyone having handheld tech. What do you do in your classroom?
Well, you know, you brought up an interesting parallel because the law says or the rules say everything must be stowed. The law actually says in California that you have to put all your electronic devices away. Students can't use them in the classroom.
There's a law about it?
There is.
That's ridiculous.
And it's from,
whose
I don't know how many years ago it is.
Is it a teaching regulation?
It's a state law.
State law.
It's a state law. And, but, you know, there's nobody ever enforces it, right? So we have a policy at our school and in our district that students will not use technology, period. Now, what they're talking about.
In the classroom.
Classroom. They're talking about iPhones, they're talking about iPads, those type of devices. You know, calculators are okay because you need calculators.
What about pencils? Because pencils are a very good example of technology.
But those are okay because they're not electronic.
Yeah, right, right.
You know? But, you know, we have teachers who are adamant about that. Cell phones are not permitted. I will take it away from you and you'll get in trouble, you, on and on and on. And then we have teachers who leverage that technology.
Pretty I'm assuming you're the latter.
I'm one of those, yes. Pretty much every one of my students has a cell phone or an iPod or something that they bring with them. And I let them use it.
Why?
And I teach them the appropriate place and time to use it. When I'm talking to them, when they're working on a project that doesn't require it, they don't use them. When they can use them or when it's appropriate, when they're watching a video, for instance, of one of my instructional videos, or when they're looking at reference material. You know, it's easy to have a document on your phone that you're looking at while you're working on a project.
Yeah.
I teach computer science, and so, you know, kids are looking at stuff all the time.
Sure.
And it's just one more device for them to look at.
Okay, but how do you control that? I mean, if you're doing a lecture, but maybe you're some time to actually do some, you know, fill out a worksheet or work on some calculations or something, and students are working on their phone. It's possible, of course, that they're doing Facebook, right? It's possible that they're...
It is.
Yeah.
It is.
And so how do you... Why do you think it's...
That's part of the teaching them the appropriate time and place. I mean, they're 15, 16, 17 years old, right? You'd expect them to do stuff like that.
Their parents are doing it.
Sure. I mean, how many times do we all sit in meetings and we're checking our email and doing other stuff?
Sure.
You know, so... I just watch them, see what they're doing, and, you know, if it's excessive, if in the big picture it's not appropriate, then I'll call them on it.
So what about having the school? I mean, the cell phone usage is difficult because, of course, you can't control what the cell phone data is. But you could theoretically put a Wi-Fi access point in your classroom, say, connect to that, and then just block different sites.
Well,
what about
that
idea?
And we do that. Our district does that. We have Wi-Fi in all of our classrooms, and students who hook into that can't access Facebook, and they can't access a lot of this. YouTube even is blocked for us.
Because there's nothing educational on YouTube.
Right, right.
I mean, there's a little bit of dogma there. I mean, that's kind of ridiculous as well, right?
True. And some districts do, some districts don't. It depends on the district. But all they do to get around, they just disconnect from the Wi-Fi.
Right.
Now they
use
can see Facebook and they can... They use their data plan.
And then the one kid that has a Wi-Fi hot point with their data plan, they'll just let the friends connect to it. Like, there's no way to stop.
Exactly. There is no way to stop.
Unless, of course, you made a Faraday cage around the school or around your classroom. Can you, since you're a physics teacher, can you describe what a Faraday cage is?
It's a big metal box. A big metal box. And, yeah, that would be something impressive.
Yeah.
See that.
I thought you could do it
school.
With netting.
Or is the
netting?
You can.
Sure, you could.
You could.
That's right. But you know, it's teaching them when is the appropriate time to use your technology.
Yeah.
That's really what it is, and that's really what they need because you're not going to stop the use.
And where are you going to learn it, right? If in the classroom in general you get you're doing a criminal act by having your phone out, and that's the environment where you're learning the skills of listening and participating in conversation, all of these things, and then you leave that classroom environment in the real world, these things happen all the time.
All the time, exactly.
You've got a problem. Like, that's the time to learn it. And an absolute mandate of no doesn't teach you anything except for to play by the rules, which I think high school students aren't very good at anyway.
No, but you make the rules relevant.
Yeah.
And make them appropriate for, you know, what they're for their environment and what they're going to see. Now, my students are mostly juniors and seniors, so I know they're really close to going out to college and going out and, you know, getting a job and being on their own and stuff. And so, you know, that's part of their responsibility is teach them that appropriateness.
Okay, so these little amazing computers that are handheld and all of them potentially have these things. You've got one problem that I could see is that it's possible some kids aren't going to have these, right? These are expensive devices, and depending on your district, you can have a student that does not have the resources to have one of those things. Are you compensating for that and having an extra couple devices? That's the way to handle
that.
Right?
I have a few laptops that they can borrow, they can take home. We figure out a way.
Right, good.
We figure out a way.
It was one of the reasons why when I was at UCSC, we mandated in the grad program to actually everyone had to have a laptop. Not that, you know, it was possible not to go through the arts program without a laptop because we had machines and everything, but we wanted to make sure that we could, because it was a requirement, we could therefore allow people to write grants to get their, you know, people that needed subsidies could get subsidies for the laptop as well. But in any case, now they've got all these powerful devices with you, and you've got a curriculum I'm assuming you've been honing over the years. Physics, definitely, and especially computer science, changes over the years in teaching. How are you leveraging the power of these little devices to enhance the education that you're giving them?
Let them use it, basically.
Hands off, go for it.
Well, my curriculum that I use in my classroom is all on Google Drive and Google Docs and Sites, and that's how they access.
Oh, so you're not doing printing stuff?
I haven't. The last thing I printed out was the first week of school, my syllabus, so the parents could sign it.
That's it. Wow. That's all I print. Yeah, so the Google Docs thing, is that a relationship that the entire district has with Google? Is it private? No, you just use it public.
My class.
Okay.
I have an Apps for Education account.
Do you give every student their own Gmail account that's only school related?
I give them an Apps for Education account that's on my domain, and I disable the Gmail. Yeah. I don't want them emailing from my class domain. Now, a lot of them have their own email.
But they can be part of Google Groups, so you can have chats, web pages, so they can actually make...
Yeah, well, when they come in the class, they log into their account on my classroom domain, and that's how they do their work and access their work.
And turn in their stuff.
And you can check on their work. I don't collect papers. Right. I don't grade papers. I don't grade real papers. I look at stuff online. So I basically don't bring anything to school or take anything home other than my computer.
So the kids aren't lugging around books and boxes.
Not for my class. My books are online.
So we've got three kids, and my wife is driving them back and forth because there's three different schools involved. And so the kids spend a little time after school. Yeah, traveling in a car. And my son's like, I can't do my math homework because I can't really do it on my phone, and it requires me to be online. Like he uses, you know, all his math homework's online. And so I'm like, well, bring the book you're supposed to read. So the solution, of course, to that is when you are traveling, you don't have network. A paper book is still a viable solution. But at the same time, sometimes, you know, he just won't have the textbook he needs because some of the classrooms, of course, aren't online. And so the textbook is a physical textbook, which is only every other day. In any case, so there's a lot of problems that the technology solves, right? I mean, we're in a world where you can scan everything, you can have everything digitized, and you can have it all as long as you've got network, of course.
Certainly makes my life easier.
Yeah.
And I think it makes theirs easier, too, because they're not bringing textbooks back and forth. But they do have to have internet access, and they do have to, a lot of times, plan ahead, too. You know, kids who are going on a trip or going away for a weekend, you know, they've either got to plan ahead, get their work done ahead of time, or to figure out a way to get it done while they're gone.
Yeah. So it's great for collaboration, too. And I'm assuming if you do experimental stuff, you have groups working together, right?
Yeah, I do group projects. Yeah. And so I'll have four kids in a group, and they're all using Google Doc to write their project. Or coding through GitHub collaborative tool. Yeah.
Now, are you using a private repo for GitHub or is this public?
No, it's public.
So all your student work is actually going on GitHub and you're supporting the students pushing their stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's awesome. I got to take a look at some of the repos. That's fantastic. So we're talking with Roger Jaffe about his experience teaching and using technology in the classroom. I have kids, and also, so I'm very interested in this issue. It's rising that the kids get more and more tech at school. And I've got a soft spot for physics high school because my favorite classes by far was physics with Preston Boomer, an amazing man. Have I ever brought you to Boomeria, Ben? I've got to bring you up to Boomeria sometime and see his place. He's got a castle and an organ and underground catacombs and stuff all built by students.
What?
Fantastic guy.
So
in his curriculum... was inspiring and probably why I know such a broad knowledge about physics, like why we were able to, when we talked about bouncing batteries of charge, we could come up with ideas of why that might happen. And years of Geek Speak experience I attribute because of that core classroom. So thank you for being a physics teacher in high school. That's awesome. Computer science teaching? I've got some issues around it. So maybe
oh, come on.
That.
Well, computer science is cool.
So is it computer science or is it engineering or, I mean, in computer science, what we're talking about is a discipline of understanding algorithms and understanding concepts of that nature. When you're talking about programming, you're actually talking about applied science, mm-hmm. which is engineering, well, right? So programming is more of an engineering, which of course you're an engineer.
That's the way I think about it is my job is to teach them programming algorithms, concepts around programming, how to create methods, I guess, to solve problems using programming.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we happen to do that with Java, and so that's the language we're using. 6 years ago, this curriculum would have been in C++. It doesn't really matter what language we use.
Sure.
We use this language as a conduit to understand the concepts of computer programming.
Yeah.
So in the sense that it's problem solving, I think it is engineering,
mm-hmm.
for sure.
Yeah, I'm constantly thinking about that aspect because, of course, the science aspect is about esoteric. But when you're actually having them codify stuff, you're actually having them produce programs, mm-hmm. which I'm assuming you are.
Mm-hmm.
It's definitely more of an engineering task. And the reason I brought up physics, because you're an engineering teacher in high school, is that we didn't have engineering when I was in mm-hmm. school, right? So we had drafting, I think, was the closest thing.
Mm-hmm.
So the dreaming space of physics and chemistry, of course, applied in the sense of figuring out moles of mm-hmm.
Well, you know, and we have a full engineering program for high school, starting in ninth grade with a survey course, and 10th grade mostly mechanical engineering, and then we have an electronics course which I also teach, computer science, and we have a civil engineering course as well. And I mean, they're not going to go walk into a job with it. With the training, but they've had exposure to it, and it's something where they say, yeah, I really dig this. I'm going to go do this in college.
How big is the high school you're teaching?
About 2,500 students.
Yeah, it's a big high school.
Mm-hmm.
My kids don't have access to some of those programs at my small school. Well, thank you, Roger, for talking a bit about your teaching. We're going to continue that, but first, hey, this is Geek Speak on 88.9 KUSP and KUSP.org. I'm Lyle Troxell, and with me in the air room is Ben Jaffe and Roger Jaffe. We're talking about, well, high school a bit and teaching, but also about the geek news of the week, including our favorite hate, which is Comcast hate. Got some of that, Ben?
Yeah, Comcast. So this story made me so happy. The city council of, I think it's pronounced Worcester, Massachusetts, so that's 180,000 people, and they are attempting to block Comcast from entering their area, which is fantastic. I mean, I don't think this has happened before. So basically Comcast, so they're the largest cable provider in the U.S., and they're trying to get a cable television license specifically for that city. And part of that is because they recently purchased Time Warner Cable, and so for whatever business reasons, it makes sense for them now to apply for a license. So
is there already cable in that area?
There is not Comcast. I'm not sure if there's other cable,
okay.
but
there's another
I
cable
imagine
cable.
There must be.
Mm-hmm.
But the city council voted 8-3 to urge Worcester's city manager to let the company's request die. Basically, just don't respond to it and don't grant them a license. Now, I mean, that's pretty fantastic. The council does not have any ability to make this actually happen. All they can do
is say we don't want it.
Oh, a Worcester, sorry. All they can do is just say, like, hey, please don't let them in, you know, and the decision is actually the manager, right? But I just really love
what manager?
The
existing city manager.
Yeah, the city manager.
City manager. Oh, I see.
But I especially like this story because I want to read this quote. This is city councilor Gary Rosen said, "It's a terrible company. In my opinion, they should not be welcome in this city. Comcast is a wolf in wolf's clothing. It's that bad. They are awful, no doubt about it."
Wow.
All right.
What does he really feel?
Right. I mean, of course, one of the main reasons everyone hates Comcast is that their customer service is really bad. And that is actually cited as the chief reason that the license they're saying should be denied. So,
but have you noticed large companies like that an eroding of customer service.
Mm-hmm.
Comcast with DirecTV and AT&T and all the other big companies out
there.
Yeah, I mean,
it's bad. You know, what's interesting, I just had an AT&T complaint and a problem with my system, and I decided to call tech support. That was the direction I got. But it was business tech support for AT&T, right? It's a phone for the company I work for, and so there's a business relationship. And I got a human being who said, oh, I'm reading a book with Lyle as the main character. And we have a conversation about stuff, and then like, where are you located? Are you located in the Skittles office? Yeah, we chatted, and it was like a good person, and I liked who she was, and she helped me. And then she's like, well, I'll call you back in a few minutes and we'll make sure this works. And she did. And why can't we get the kind of customer service? We just clearly companies aren't putting enough money behind the customer service is the issue. Because, of course, the business relationships, there's a lot of money there, so they care.
Well, that's an interesting question. Are they putting, quote-unquote, enough money behind it? I mean, I imagine it must be a decision that they're making to allow two-hour wait times or whatever it is to be the norm.
Right.
Like, they would respond to it if they wanted that not to happen, if they really cared about customer service.
So,
and if you look at, like, for example, my mobile phone provider is a reseller of Sprint called Ting, and you call them and they immediately pick up and there's a person there, right? And that's probably because they're a small company. If they got really huge, or if you take someone like Sprint or AT&T or Comcast or anyone, when you're big enough, you don't need to care as much about customer service because people don't have as much choice.
How can I provide you excellent service today?
Yes.
One of my pet peeves.
May as well not ask the question.
Well, there's a bit of fighting back, at least local government and stuff saying no.
Yeah, and what's probably going to happen is even if the manager says, all right, we'll let the request die, Comcast will just keep applying and applying and applying until eventually they will get it. So, but it's nice to, at least as a symbolic measure, to do that.
So, right now at ThinkGeek, ThinkGeek has great geeky stuff to buy, and these are awesome. Mentioned by Al, who's of course our crazy USB of the week guy who sometimes records wonderful bits for us, and hopefully he'll do that again soon. But this one I can't pass up because it's a narwhal USB heated plush slipper. That's right, a USB slipper you can put on your feet that looks like a narwhal whale. That's the type
narwhal?
That has narwhal. Yeah, it has the like horn on the front, and you can walk around. Now they keep your feet cozy. I'll read the little description. Narwhal shaped plush heated slippers use a foot warming when attached to USB. Detach from USB to travel in cozy comfort. I just love them. Look at the picture.
What?
They're so adorable.
Oh, my God. That's adorable. You know, the narwhals are the best. Narwhals are as close to a magical creature as you can get while still being real. They have the single horn. They look like unicorns of the sea.
That's right. Lovely. All right, let's get on.
I know what Ben's getting for Christmas.
Oh, Ben's totally getting for Christmas.
I would love a narwhal.
Oh, I want some. Ben,
narwhals and manatees.
I was working on some stuff and saw that colleagues of mine were talking all about the Apple announcements yesterday. And one big thing that happened is the new version of OS X is out, 10.10, which just feels a little wrong from a mathematics perspective. Shouldn't it be 11? But
well,
it is
10.10. The other thing is OS X, 10.10 is what a lot of the headlines say. OS X... 10.10, but the X is the 10.
For redundancy.
So,
it's so frustrating.
I actually probably spent about 45 seconds writing it in our planning Google Doc, and I ended up writing OS 10, 10.10, because it was just, it looked awkward otherwise.
Yeah. Okay.
You can't say X.10. That's just weird.
I don't know. Roman numerals.
Try writing it. It looks weird. It just does not
In any case, is it ready? If my device is telling me the App Store that I can upgrade, is it going to be painful? Or it's going to be easy?
I don't know. I can't tell you.
Really?
I mean,
you haven't
done
it yet?
All right. So, no, I've not done it. And also, everyone's experience will be different. Probably the vast majority of people will be able to upgrade, and it'll be really smooth and easy. And some people will love it, and some people will hate it. And then eventually everyone will love it when the next one's coming up because, you know, people are resistant to change acclimate.
The way to guarantee you'll have trouble is to do it when you don't have a whole lot of time.
Yes, rush. Yeah, I thought about doing it right before the show today. That would have been good. So this is called, of course, OS X Yosemite has been the nickname of it and the name, the brand
Finally,
name.
Finally, it's named after a place that everyone recognizes instead of the last place.
Or Mavericks?
Mavericks, which is like some obscure surfing spot. Which
it's
is
not obscure to us, it isn't.
we're on the West Coast right nearby.
Yeah.
So anyway, there are a whole bunch of new things. I'm not going to go over the entire feature set and everything, but there are a lot of interface changes. There aren't a ton of new features that I'm excited about. It seems that one of the big things about this OS upgrade is that it adds a lot of tying together with iOS. So if you have an iPhone or an Apple Watch or whatever you happen to have, it should tie in with that a lot better. I have an Android device, yeah. So.
So this means on an iOS device with the newest version of the operating system, version 8, you can be like writing an email, and then you walk over to your computer that has Yosemite on it, and you can continue writing that email, right? Yeah. So they're synced up a bit, which is kind of cool. Mm-hmm. Mavericks, California, by the way, is a location approximately 2 miles from shore outside Pillar Point Harbor, just north of the town of Half Moon Bay. So it's just up the coast from us.
Yeah.
It's true. It's very close to us.
But even so, I didn't know about it. And
really?
And I spent years here.
You were not a surfer?
No. Yeah. Not a surfer.
Well, if you were born and raised in Santa Cruz, you know all about Mavericks.
There is one other cool thing that's in Yosemite, which is JavaScript automation. So now you can actually write JavaScript to automate things that happen on your screen. So it's kind of cool. Now, the operating system is not using JavaScript, but you can use JavaScript to interact with it. And there's also a built-in Objective-C bridge, which lets you kind of bridge the gap between the JavaScript you're writing and the Objective-C that the language is running on. So there is a wonderful, wonderful breakdown of all of the new stuff and all the things that have changed over at Ars Technica. And that is what will be up on geekspeak.org, or is up on geekspeak.org if you're a podcast listener.
Great. And Greg Markley, our remote geek, suggests 10 cubed.
10 cubed.
OS 10 cubed, which is kind of a cool idea.
10 dot, oh.
Hey,
it's just awkward because 10.10 is mathematically the same as 10.1.
That's true.
Which
should have already happened a long time ago.
That was a really bad operating system compared to what we have now. I don't know.
Well, that is the versioning pattern they're using is a common versioning pattern in software.
That's true.
So. We joke about it, but actually, as programmers, we know what we're talking. We know it's right.
It is right. It's just
anyway.
It's
you know what else is right? When it's raining, having an umbrella.
Okay.
Okay. But the problem with umbrellas, of course, is they just don't have enough electronics in them. That's always been my problem.
What? Okay.
I once had an umbrella that had a flashlight in it, which was pretty cool. But
did the flashlight go up? Because that would be pretty.
No,
useless.
You could like the flashlight did go up, but when you opened it, it went down. So it had like little. It broke really quickly. Umbrellas also break really quickly because there's all these moving small parts, and you're using them always in wind. And
do
so
do you have a solution to this?
Well, somebody has a solution, and that is the air umbrella.
What?
And the best part about it is that it creates a force field that keeps you dry. An air
is
umbrella.
Is that force field in air quotes?
It isn't. No, it wasn't.
Are we
but
talking
it should have
about?
Been. It is an air force field. So there you go. So this is a.
Is it a field? What? Okay. What is it?
So the air umbrella looks like a giant wand. I don't know, like Willy Wonka would dance with, you know, and a baton. And at the
a
top,
cane?
And the top, it has a fan system that pushes air out horizontally in all directions. So you put it above your head and you turn it on, and it blows air quickly out the sides,
out of the top.
That causes the droplets that are coming straight down on you to then be pushed out to the sides. And so it's an umbrella that just uses wind.
So you're just holding this stick and suddenly you're dry.
Yes, in the photograph, the art obviously shows it. But once you see the actual wand, you can see an idea of how it works.
Oh.
But that presumes the water is coming straight down.
Well, of course, umbrellas always presume that. Umbrellas also assume
can,
that,
can
right?
Can you tip it to face into the wind?
Yeah. It's a windshield, right? So you can. I think that a high enough speed wind would probably go past the 4 9-volt batteries or something it's using, whatever it's using for extra power.
It hasn't
power.
Rained where I live for 2 years, so I don't
know. So you're totally fine. You don't need it.
I don't need it.
Can
it'd
I
be
buy
cool
this?
To try it.
You can sign up for the campaign. It's currently raised about $35,000, which exceeds the $10,000 goal.
So it's
and that's
a Kickstarter.
On Kickstarter campaign.
Oh, okay.
That's right. So we'll see if it actually works. I can't wait to see someone else that buys it, because then I will try it.
Right. That's how I felt about
it. Can I borrow it?
Yeah.
That's how I felt about Google Glass.
Ouch.
And then you got one.
Hey, I haven't been wearing Google Glass for like 5 days.
Yeah, you look a lot more human.
I feel more connected to the world. I haven't missed it that much, a little bit. I keep on being late for meetings and appointments. But other than that, I'm not missing it that much.
You could get a watch.
Hey, I wanted to cover some really geeky news. We don't do this all the time, but you and I both have some stuff that's probably appropriate for a programming audience. So first off, you suggested something that everybody can use, and that is a key command. In fact, you have a Twitter group that's about key commands. And this one was, we use a Google Doc when we're doing the show, and you can link things in a Google Doc with a URL. And yes. I didn't know you could do that with a key command. That was
really
simple.
Yeah, so we were planning the show a little, just a couple minutes before the show went on, and I hit command K.
What you did,
enter.
You said, you want a link? And you went,
want a link?
And I just saw your hands move quickly, and all of a sudden the link appeared in the Google Doc. I'm like, how do you do that?
Command K.
Brings
if you
up
press command K in most text fields that support links, it'll make a link.
Awesome.
Also, if
or prompt you for a link, making a link.
Also, if you are on a Mac and you have the Finder selected, you press Command K and it'll open up a Connect to Server window.
Yes, I knew that.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, also Command K in Lightroom prompts you to add a keyword to the photo you currently have, which is kind of like a link as well.
All right. Yeah,
I'm trying to teach my students about shortcuts because watching them click with a trackpad
drives you insane.
Copy, edit, paste, Control C, Control V, do it. Trust me.
You learn this. You will never regret learning
That's right.
I was in a presentation yesterday and they were playing a video and stopping a video and playing a video and stopping a video and playing a video and stopping a video. And it was using QuickTime. And all you have to do that is push the space bar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But they were using the trackpad and clicking. And then when you click, of course, you get the space bar for most playing devices will stop and start play, including like iTunes and things of that nature.
Escape will get you out of there wherever there is.
Yes, escape always gets you out of there.
Almost always.
We could do a whole show on key commands we love, huh?
We could. It'd be really great radio.
Yeah. All right. Greg suggests that if you have the air umbrella shield, don't people around you get a lot wetter?
Oh, that's a good point.
Flown sideways velocity water.
So you can't have two people standing next to each other with
air
umbrellas?
Well, if they do it perfectly, then they'll have like a little trough in between them that the wind fights and drops the water down.
You can only walk next to somebody who you're the exact same height as.
Not necessarily.
And then you're holding the air umbrella at the same height.
Could you walk with somebody?
Ben like could.
You could
He's
share
a friendly
an umbrella.
Guy.
You know?
Yeah.
All right. Koalas could.
Let's talk about some really highly geeky stuff. Ben, for Google developers, what's available right now? For Android developers, excuse me, what's available right now?
Air umbrella Kickstarter?
No, isn't the Android...
Yeah, that's right. The Android SDK for Android 5.0.
Lollipop.
Yeah. So the SDK, that stands for Software Development Kit. Basically, if you are writing Android apps, then you can write your apps or upgrade your apps or modify your apps to work on Android 5.0 Lollipop. And then when it comes out in a couple weeks or whatever, your apps will be ready.
Right. I think it's been longer than that, most likely, but maybe not. So the SDK is available, the operating system, even beta is available?
I believe so.
Yeah. When we're talking about versions of software, of course, for these non-geeks, Android 5 is a lot like iOS 8, right? That's the version number of the operating system. And names, of course, are very common in this environment. Lollipop,
yeah, and the number doesn't necessarily mean anything if you compare two pieces
That's
of
right.
software.
In fact,
like OS 10.10 versus Android 5.0 versus, I don't know, VLC version 0.9.2.
I would say that Android 5.0 is comparable to iOS 8. I mean, because they're launching around the same time and they have very similar features.
Yeah.
I think Android people would say that there's a lot more features in Android than
iOS. The only reason the version numbers really exist is to distinguish one version of a piece of software from the same software, the previous version,
That's
or
right.
the one before that.
All right.
Yeah.
So the SDK is available. Start coding if you're doing Android development. So I'll mention something that I was solving recently, and that is we use SAS, which is a precompiler for
CSS.
CSS.
Yeah.
And this is the geeky part of GeekSpeak. Sorry about that.
And,
and we do web development, so a lot of and we're doing a web app, and so a lot of the coding I'm doing is in JavaScript. So SAS is like a programming language almost, but a markup language that has variables and mathematics that's inside CSS, but CSS doesn't actually have much of that. So it compiles or it translates that the way I write it to something that's more directly a CSS document during compile time or during build time.
Okay.
And that is useful. Let's say you have a color, but you're using the color in a lot of places, a lot of selectors, or using a modification of the color. When you're in SAS, you can say the color is red, and then you can say the border is a darker of red, or 4% darker of red.
And then you change the one red variable, and you change it to blue, and all of a sudden you have blue and darker blue.
And that darker red, I don't have to say it's darker red. I can just say it's darker of the original variable. Mm-hmm. And that way, if I change the original variable, of blue, the darker is going to be that much darker of blue. So there's really great reasons to have in styling programming capabilities. Mm-hmm. One of the things you can do is width and height and padding and margin and things of that nature, which is about spacing of the boxes in CSS. And thing that I ran into the other day where I needed in my programming environment, the JavaScript side, to actually calculate out values. And the same values that I need as bases, the padding and the margin, were inside my SAS document, inside the other document already. So I had to duplicate these variables in two different places. From a computer science perspective, Roger, I'm assuming that's bad.
You don't want to duplicate.
There's an acronym, DRY, DRY.
Do not repeat
Speaking
yourself.
Of umbrellas, yes. Yeah.
Yeah. So, or don't repeat. Yeah,
don't repeat yourself.
What was it again?
Don't repeat yourself.
Yes, three times. You repeated yourself. So in any case, there's a wonderful plugin for SAS called SAS JSON VARS. Ben, what does it do?
I don't know. I've never
SAS,
used it. But I'm
SAS JSON VARS.
I'm guessing it takes your variables in your SAS document, spits it out in JSON, and you can use it.
Yeah, you make your actual document in JSON, and then both SAS and JavaScript load it up.
And this last part is great for web developers. Not so great for anyone else.
Told you it was geeky. Hey, but a lot of information up at geekspeak.org. You can listen to the show multiple times if you'd like. Geekspeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission. And Geekspeak is a Creative Commons Attribution 3, so share it any way you like. Tell them the geek sent you. This is Public Radio for the Central Coast, 889 KOSP Santa Cruz, live online at KOSP.org. To find out more about every episode, geekspeak.org. I'm Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Ben and Roger. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.